Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, broadcasting through our studios in New York City, and I welcome you. We are being simulcast throughout the world, including our sister station, WBAI in New York, where I've been on the air for nearly 38 years. Our sister station in Washington, D.C., on WPFW for 31 years. Today, a continuation of our ongoing, original, in-depth investigative reporting series on John F. Kennedy's assassination. We have three panelists today. We'll be beginning in a moment with former Governor Jesse Ventura. We're going to look at the Warren Commission as evidence of complicity and other mysterious deaths, and the relevance and lessons of the JFK assassination for today. We will then go to a person who I've known for a long time as a scholar on the issue, Robert Morningstar. Robert is a trained psychologist. He is a civilian intelligence and photo film analyst. He is also a person who has new information today, information that is a breaking story, exclusive, evidence of shots from the grassy knoll based upon film analysis looking for vapor trails. And he'll go into that in depth. And then in the second hour of our program today, Vincent Palomera. Vincent is going to explain to us the failures of the Secret Service and a look at the medical forensics following Kennedy's death. Robert Morningstar, who did the original compilation, he was the first researcher that I'm aware of that actually showed that what we were told was Kennedy's brain was indeed not, and he'll explain that in detail. I've spent hundreds of hours reviewing these photographs and the forensics on this. Just to give a little background, when we do a report like this, it's not just cut and pasted together. It's taken us nearly 9 months of research, first because there are thousands of people claiming that they have insights. But when you look carefully, frequently the insights are based upon conjecture, third person, fourth person, hearsay, innuendo. They lack the kind of prima facie evidence that is necessary. So wherever possible, we try to keep the guest to the points of what is your proof. I believe that anyone looking at the mainstream media today would be sorely disappointed. Not a single major journalist on cable network or in mainstream media, or in any of the major media, from the Washington Post to the New York Times, have raised the question, is it possible that the Warren Commission got it wrong? Is it possible that there was a conspiracy? And if so, who would have had the power? You couldn't have assassinated Kennedy and gotten away with it as a lone gunman. You would have had to know that you could do cover-up. You could do assassination of those who were involved in it to make sure that you remove them. You created a firewall. Who had that power? We'll explore all that on today's program. And if we can do it with the limited resources we have, then you have to wonder why no one else has done this with the massive amount of resource they have. Let's now go to our first guest, who is out of Minnesota, and he is one of the nation's stronger progressive political and social voices, Jesse Ventura. He was a Navy SEAL during the latter phase of the Vietnam War, followed by a career in the World Wrestling Federation, a national sportscaster, followed by a career in politics. In the early 1990s, Jesse began his political career, first as a mayor of Brooklyn Park in Minnesota, later being elected as the state's governor from 1998 to 2002. He's been an ardent supporter of the Main Street American causes and a leading critic against executive and legislative policies that are leading the U.S. into becoming a police surveillance state. In 2011, he filed a lawsuit against the Transportation Security Administration, or the TSA, for illegal searches. He also hosted the TV series Conspiracy Theory for 3 seasons. He's written several books, and his latest is They Killed Our President, 63 Reasons to Believe There Was a Conspiracy to Assassinate JFK, Skyhorse Publishing. Nice to have you with us today, Jesse.
Hi, Gary. Always nice to be with you.
Some have said that enough evidence for there being a conspiracy to murder President Kennedy can be found in the Warren Commission report itself. The contradictions within the report, much that is almost nonsensical and defies common sense, and how it was conducted and who oversaw it. In short, it was a messy and distorted report. Let's begin, please, by reading a few paragraphs from a memo written by the acting attorney general, Nicholas Katzenbach, to Lyndon Johnson's aide, Bill Moyers, the same Bill Moyers that we've seen for decades on PBS. This is 3 days after the assassination. Quote, "The public must be satisfied that Oswald was the assassin, that he did not have Confederates who are still at large, and that the evidence was such that he would have been convicted at trial. Speculation about Oswald's motivation ought to be cut off, and we should have some basis for rebutting thought that this was a communist conspiracy, or, as the Iron Curtain Press is saying, a right-wing conspiracy to blame it on the communist. Unfortunately, the facts on Oswald seem too pat, too obvious. Marxist, Cuba, Russian wife." The Dallas Police have put out statements on the communist conspiracy theory, and it was they who were in charge when he was shot and thus silenced. Then the memo goes on to read, quote, "I think this objective may be satisfied by making public as soon as possible a complete and thorough FBI report on Oswald and the assassination. The only other step would be the appointment of a presidential commission of unimpeachable personnel to review and examine evidence and announce its conclusions," end quote. So please let us take a look at the real meaning and significance of this memo, since it was only 3 days after the assassination and 1 day after Jack Ruby killed Oswald. Then go into some of the details of how the Warren Commission was structured, the key persons orchestrating the commission behind the scenes, and then how this structure enabled the anti-Kennedy factions within the government, especially the military, the CIA, the FBI, to cover up their tracks. The forum is yours. Take your time.
Well, thanks, Gary. The interesting thing, too, is if we go to the end of the Katzenbach memo, and you go to the last little line on it, it says, "We need something to head off public speculation or congressional hearings of the wrong sort." Now, I would love, Gary, the definition of what a congressional hearing of the wrong sort is. That means the truth? An honest hearing? I'm not sure what they mean, a congressional hearing of the wrong sort, and we need to head those off. Well, they did form the Warren Commission, and it's ironic some of the people that they put on that commission, like Alan Dulles, who happened to be the former head of the CIA, who John Kennedy fired after the Bay of Pigs fiasco and made the statement that he was going to break the CIA into 1,000 pieces. Then they put, I forget the other guy, who was head of the Chase Manhattan Bank and the banking system of the world, and Kennedy had already stated and gone to war with them. There was a great chance he was going to take on the Federal Reserve, which, of course, you're not allowed to do in any way, shape, or form. The key, I think, to the Kennedy situation was how many enemies that he made when he got in office, because each and every one of these enemies had the power to do what happened, and if they ever got together, it gave them unbelievable power. Let's go down the list, if we can, for a moment, of who despised Kennedy. Naturally, there was the mafia. Bobby Kennedy, as Attorney General, was waging war on the mafia, so they didn't like Kennedy. He had deported Carlos Marcello of New Orleans and shipped him out of the country, so they were extremely angry. Then you had the CIA, naturally. I already spoke of them, with Dulles and the firing of Cabell and Bissell, the top three guys, and he was going to break them into 1,000 pieces, so he made the CIA an enemy. He made the oil industry an enemy because he was going to take away the oil depletion allowance, which was the big tax write-off so that Hunt and these guys could make $30 million a year and pay nothing in taxes, and the president felt that was wrong. You naturally have the Cubans in Florida that disliked him because he wouldn't support the Bay of Pigs invasion, and the list goes on and on. And then naturally, whenever you look at a homicide, you, any police detective will tell you this. The first thing you look at is who had the most to gain from this murder. And if you look at it from that aspect, it comes clear it was Lyndon Johnson who had the most to gain from it. At the time of the Kennedy killing, Lyndon Johnson was neck deep in two major scandals, the Billy Saul Estes scandal and the Bobby Baker scandal in Texas. There were people thinking he was going to prison for them, and there was also speculation that Kennedy was going to drop him from the ticket in 64 because he really didn't need Johnson in the South anymore. He was extremely popular. He was going to win re-election. There was no doubt about it. And he didn't need Lyndon Johnson anymore. So Johnson stands as someone who stood to gain the most. Magically, those Billy Saul Estes, Bobby Baker scandals disappeared the moment he became president. You never heard of them again, or never heard of him being involved in them again. And, of course, there was the reversal. The Pentagon and the Joint Chiefs wanted to go to war. Kennedy wouldn't go to war in Cuba. He wasn't going to go to war in Vietnam. In fact, he had ordered the first 1,000 advisors out by Christmas. And, of course, Lyndon Johnson reversed that the minute he got into office. And I'll finish with this, and then we'll go to the actual Warren Commission for a moment. But Lyndon Johnson, I read a book called LBJ's First 48 Hours in Office. And I found it extremely interesting that when he flew back to Dallas and he met with Kennedy's cabinet, the first meeting, because, you know, Kennedy's cabinet was still there, and he would have to govern with them. And his first meeting with the Kennedy cabinet, now you'd think it would be over the State of the Union, or the economy, or where's the country at. His first meeting with Kennedy's cabinet was the Vietnam War, was the topic. Now, excuse me, at that point in time in 63, Vietnam wasn't even a war to us. All we had were advisors that had been sent there by the Eisenhower administration. It was never a declared war to begin with, but we had no troops per se on the ground. Why would that be the first meeting you would have as president? I found that astounding when I read it, having been a governor and know that if I came in as a new governor, what would be the first meeting I would have with the old governor's staff? It certainly wouldn't be over a war that had yet to be fought. So isn't that interesting, Gary?
Yes, it is. The commission's argument is that Lee Harvey Oswald was a single, lone, and crazed gunman. You were trained as a Navy SEAL, and therefore you are certainly familiar with marksman rifles and sharpshooting skills. So challenge or deconstruct the official argument of the shots coming from a single shooter and share with us the story of the discovery of the Mauser rifle with no fingerprints and the controversy over the rifle's paper trail. Why is the discovery of this weapon important? And also, there's evidence that Oswald was not a very good shooter. Speak on the evidence to support this and that he would not be skilled enough to fire the shots according to the Warren Report's own conclusions.
Well, first of all, let's go to my television show where I tried to recreate the shots. And I was an expert marksman in both rifle and pistol when I was in the United States Navy. It was a requirement for the unit, the underwater demolition SEAL team, the Naval Special Forces, or what we refer to as the Brown Water Navy. That's a requirement. You have to be an expert marksman. So Oswald was not. And clearly he wasn't because of this. When you go into the military, they give you batteries of tests and examinations because they're not dumb. They want to use you to the best of your ability, and they want to find out where your abilities lie. Well, Lee Harvey Oswald was not a good shot. His shooting scores show that, and he was subsequently sent to radar technician. So Oswald wasn't even a rifle-carrying Marine. For lack of better terminology and no disrespect, he was a pencil pusher. Now, granted, you need those also, especially in a mechanized military. You certainly need proficient radar operators. But radar operators don't carry weapons necessarily, and they certainly don't shoot them on a regular basis. Now, in my book, we go to a fellow by the name of, not only could I not make the shots when we created them, and I didn't even have moving targets, I also showed that the first shot would be the most accurate, because when I wanted to to be accurate with the first shot, I could be. I could hit the targets. It was the second and third recycling the bolt and getting back on target that were next to impossible. And yet they tell you Oswald missed with his first shot. The second shot was the magic bullet, and the third shot was the fatal head wound. So he got progressively better when logic and common sense would tell you he would get progressively worse, not better. Now, going back to the shooting, if you don't believe and that maybe Oswald could outshoot me, but I highly doubt it. But if you don't believe me, we show you in our book a gentleman by the name of Carlos Hathcock. He's legendary in the Marine Corps. He is the chief instructor of the Quantico Sniper School in Quantico Marine Base. This guy is the best shot the Marine Corps has ever seen. He attempted to duplicate Oswald's shooting and made 10 attempts at it. And I urge people to read his comments in my book of what he said about it. So common sense, you're going to tell me that this Marine who probably never carried a weapon past boot camp is going to outshoot the greatest Marine Corps sniper in history? I don't think so, and neither does Carlos. And, you know, when you apply common sense to many of the things of the Warren Commission and the shooting of JFK, it doesn't pass the smell test in any way, shape, or form. Another interesting thing, Gary, is this. They allege that Oswald carried the weapon in under his arm that day. And told this Frazier guy that gave him a ride to work that he had curtain rods. Well, take a close look at the Mannlicher Carcano weapon. When you break it down, it has this unusually long wooden stock that is nearly 3 feet long. It's 34, 35 inches, I believe, in length. Now, I'm 6'4". I cannot cup that wooden stock and have it fit under my armpit. And yet they said Oswald carried the weapon under his armpit, locked into his armpit, broken down. The Mannlicher Carcano weapon cannot break down like that. So there is no witness and the only witness ever seen by the Warren Commission stated that Oswald came in the building with nothing in his hand. So where did this weapon come from? How did it get there?
That's
another million-dollar question that needs to be answered, because he certainly did not carry it in under his armpit with curtain rods like the Warren Commission stated he did.
Jesse, we also know that at that time it was common when you picked up a murder suspect, you would do a basic forensic. You would do a simple analysis. Were there gunpowder fragments anywhere around the face, the shoulder, the cheek, the fingers, the wrist, because these are the places where you would have that. That there were no fingerprints. Oswald had his fingerprints were never on the gun. How can they explain that and then show how this particular rifle that was used, which was not a modern rifle and not known for its accuracy, how they came about saying that this was Oswald's rifle?
Well, an interesting thing, too, on the Oswald rifle, the Mannlicher Carcano, when it was discovered, the sight wasn't even sighted in, and the Warren Commission admits it. They had to put two of these thin metal, what they call shins, in there to get the sight. Any hunter will tell you that you don't go hunting with an unsighted weapon because you'll never hit anything. So here's Oswald with this weapon that wasn't even sighted in. It required two shins to be placed on the telescopic sight to even make it accurate, to remount it. And the weapon itself was like a $13 or $14 weapon. It was the cheapest thing you could possibly buy. And another lie the Warren Commission perpetrated right out of J. Edgar Hoover, many questions have arose of why didn't Oswald take the shot when the president was coming directly at him before he made the turn at the book depository and was going away from him where the big Texas oak tree was in the line of fire. It was a decline that you go down there and going away from you, which is the most difficult shot. The easy shot would have been when the president was coming directly at the building. J. Edgar Hoover said that he couldn't do that shot because there were limbs in the way. And it's interesting because if you go to Harold Weisberg's book that was written in 1965, he shows a photograph and it's a completely clear shot. There is virtually no tree in the way. So Hoover lied about that. Harold Weisberg is a guy that people need to read. He wrote the book, the Whitewash series of books, way back in the mid-60s. He could not get them published. He was turned down by 113 publishing companies. It couldn't get it published in this country nor 13 other countries, and he totally rips apart the Warren Commission with their own documents. They're tremendous reads, but it's a difficult read because it's done on typewriter paper. Skyhorse, my publisher, reprints all the whitewash books by Harold Weisberg, but we need to tip our hats to Harold because he did a yeoman share of the work on this.
Let's jump ahead for 45 minutes. The murder of Dallas police officer J.D. Tippit, T-I-P-P-I-T, was about 45 minutes after Kennedy was killed, and it was also pinned on Oswald. Why is this not possible? And if Oswald did not kill Tippit, and if it was a part of the strategic design of the conspiracy, then what would have been the murderer's rationale?
Well, hard to say on that. You know, the whole Tippit murder is real foggy because they allege that Officer Tippit saw Oswald walking down the street and that he fit the description of who killed the president. Now, let's go back to that description and how they determined that. A Mr. Brenner is the only witness they used who allegedly described, saw Oswald allegedly shooting from the shooter's sixth-floor window. Well, first of all, he said he saw him standing up. If Oswald would have been standing up, he would have had to shoot through the glass because the window is 1 foot from the bottom of the floor, and it was only raised up a little bit. So the shooter would have to be way down. Even the boxes they had in the shooter nest, there was no integrity to the building. They have 5 or 6 photos where the boxes are all moved around in different positions. So the building was never sealed off. All the evidence in it, you can't count on anything. A lawyer would have a field day if this would have ever gone to court because there was never any cross-examination of any of the Warren Commission's supposed evidence that they had. And so when you go back to the fact that the description they had, how would this Mr. Brenner at all know how tall the shooter was when he's looking up into a window allegedly at him shooting when that was impossible? So they said that Tippit got word of what Oswald alleged or the shooter looked like, and he pulled over this guy who allegedly fit the description and was a suspect. The unique thing is this. If this suspect had just murdered the president, wouldn't the police officer have been a little bit more on edge? Tippit never pulled a gun. The witnesses said the guy came up and leaned into the squad car and talked to him. And then when the guy got out, Tippit started to get out. That's when the guy turned around and then shot him and took off. And they have no witnesses that tie it to Oswald that shot Tippit. The descriptions from all of the witnesses to the Tippit shooting go all over the board. They don't even have clothing is different. Everything about it is completely different. And then if you follow through from there, here's where common sense again comes in. Now imagine you've just murdered the president. You've just wounded the governor. You've just killed the police officer. What would be first on your agenda? Go to the afternoon matinee movie?
Yes.
Because that's what they allege Oswald did at that point. Yeah. He went to the movies. That's remarkable.
One of the issues we have yet to raise in this series of broadcasts on the JFK assassination is the silencing of key individuals at opportune times after the fact. So in turn, please share a bit of the mysterious deaths of the following persons, who they were, why they needed to be removed, and the circumstances of their deaths. And I would say Navy Commander William Pizer, who was stationed at the National Naval Medical Center where Kennedy's autopsy took place, David Ferry, the former pilot who knew Oswald and was a key factor in the JFK movie. And by the way, Oliver Stone's movie, and I interviewed Garrison, James Garrison, the DA who was behind all this, and many times. And he was, I'll give you his background on what he actually felt, but he knew his office had been infiltrated. Dorothy Kilgallen, American journalist and columnist, Lee Bowers, who was a key witness for activity on the grassy knoll. And then, of course, the head of the Chicago mob, Sam Giancana. Johnny Roselli, another Chicago mobster who worked with the CIA. Those are just some of the people. There's a long list. Could you go through some of the key people, how they died, what role they may have played in the association of the assassination?
Well, they all knew certain things, and they all died so weird, to use a lack of better term. They died very mysteriously, and in fact, I believe Lloyd's of London once did a test on it and found this astronomical odds that it would have been like 1 trillion something to one that all these people would have met these strange deaths who all had been part of or in some way attached to the Kennedy killing. A unique one is Dorothy Kilgallen. She was a national syndicated columnist, very well read. She never believed the Kennedy killing from day one and wrote accordingly, so she was a skeptic from day one. She was granted the only interview with Jack Ruby when Jack Ruby was in prison. And when she came out of that interview, she said publicly she was going to break the Kennedy killing wide open. Well, amazingly, now imagine she's a national journalist, that's her job, and she now has the story of the century. And yet, 1 week later, she allegedly committed suicide. Now, does that stand? Let's put the old common sense to this. Why would she do that? She's got the story of the century. She's got a story that will make her career. She will go down and be legendary. And she'd kill herself. And what's interesting about the alleged suicide, she was found in her Manhattan apartment lying on a bed that her neighbors and friends said she never used. It was a show bed at the front of the apartment. She slept in the back. She was found on this bed with her clothing on, her makeup still on. She had a book by her that her friends said she had finished reading a couple weeks earlier. And her reading glasses were nowhere to be found. So what would she be doing lying on the bed reading a book she'd already read without her reading glasses, which she required to read? See, when someone gets murdered, I think it's very Marilyn Monroe-ish on that quite possibly she could have been killed by some type of overdose that was given to her possibly rectally or in a different manner like that that would kill her. And that this, it made no sense for Dorothy Kilgallen to end up dead. And then all her notes on the JFK killing magically disappeared. Whoever came in burglarized and took them. And she was smart enough that she made copies and left them with a friend. Well, apparently they knew all that also because the friend perished short time later and those notes were likewise taken.
Go through some of the other names, please.
Pardon me?
Could you? That's interesting. I'd like to hear about, for example, one of the most important people who died under mysterious circumstances was Navy Commander William Pitzer.
Right. Well, Pitzer was involved in the film of the autopsy and things like that. And there was a CIA request put out to kill this guy because he had evidence that was very, very interesting of that I can't exactly remember what exactly Pitzer did now, because when you write these books you don't always remember all of it that you do.
How about Lee Bowers?
Lee Bowers, that I can speak to. Pitzer, you can read the chapter on him. Lee Bowers was the railroad man who was working in the tower behind the grassy knoll. And he testified to the Warren Commission how he saw people, two guys at the fence. They looked unusual, that there was this big flash and almost a puff of smoke that he saw, and he was disturbed that something extremely unusual had happened behind that fence. Well, a couple weeks after Lee Bowers testified, Lee Bowers allegedly died in a one-car auto accident near Monrovia, Texas, I believe. And when it was investigated, it was found out that it wasn't a one-car accident, that he was actually driven off the road. And that's how he died.
What about Sam Giancana?
Sam Giancana, of course, was involved. The CIA was in bed with the mafia at that stage in time attempting to assassinate Castro. And our CIA felt, I guess, that the mafia was better than Castro was, so they'd rather work with them than work with Fidel. So they, and of course, the mafia wanted to get back into Cuba because Fidel had thrown them out. So, and Sam was involved in all of the CIA operations in attempts to kill Fidel Castro. And Sam was killed the night before the House Select Committee. And let's add this to it, Gary, for a moment. The latest investigation that our government ever did was not the Warren Commission, was the House Select Committee on Assassinations in the 70s. And their conclusion was that Kennedy was killed by a probable conspiracy. So here you have a government agency stating that there was a conspiracy. The most recent investigation, they sent it on to the Justice Department. It's probably still gathering dust there. No one's ever done anything with it. And I might add, murder, there's no statute of limitations on it. You could open up the investigation again today if you felt like it, because there are no statute of limitations. Getting back to Giancana, Giancana was scheduled to testify in front of the House Select Committee on Assassinations and was murdered in his house the night before he was supposed to testify. And he was and at that time, he was under surveillance of both the FBI and the CIA when he was killed. And so they couldn't stop him, I guess, from being killed either. Another interesting character was George de Morenschild, who, as many think, was Oswald's CIA handler. George de Morenschild actually wrote a note to President George H.W. Bush at the time, who was head of the CIA, requesting help to save him from having to testify in front of the House Select Committee. And likewise, the night before or the day before George de Morenschild was to testify in front of the House Select Committee, he allegedly committed suicide also, under very shaky circumstances. In other words, he was probably murdered. And so there you have two examples of witnesses the night before they're supposed to testify to the House Select Committee, and both of them end up dead. And I guess they would mainstream media would just write that off as unbelievable circumstances, huh?
Yeah. Well, one person that was central to the actual conspiracy was David Ferry. He was a pilot. He was... he worked in science, as an amateur science, and his is an interesting story. He ended up dying under unusual circumstances. Would you like to discuss that, please?
Yeah, David Ferry was part of he was the central figure in the Jim Garrison investigation in New Orleans. He was also tied into a person I consider a friend of mine today, Judith Mary Baker, who was, for lack of better terms, Oswald's mistress and lover in New Orleans. See, Lee and Marina were separated. They were going to get divorced. And that's why they were living separate in Dallas. That's why Lee was living in the boarding house, and she was out living with Ruth Payne, and he would come out on the weekends to visit his children. And Judith was Lee's lover in New Orleans, and she fills in all the blanks. Her, David Ferry, and Oswald were all working with Dr. Alton Ochsner, the famous cancer doctor, the head of the American Cancer Society. But what they were doing was not a positive with cancer. Again, let's go back to the CIA's attempt to assassinate Castro. They were attempting to create, with Ochsner, a fast-moving cancer that would kill within, 2 months. And Oswald's job was to take that cancer down to Mexico City and pass it off there so it could be taken to Havana, and that way they would assassinate Castro with cancer. And when the autopsy came out, they would say Fidel simply died of cancer, which would cause nobody's red flag to go up that he had been assassinated. And David Ferry was part of this also, and what's unique about it, the day that Oswald got shot, Judith Ferry Baker was back in Florida. David Ferry called her and said, "Judith, if you want to live, you have to disappear." And that's what Judith did. She disappeared and ended up in Sweden, and that's where she lives today, although she wrote the book Lee and Me, and she comes back to the United States occasionally to talk about her relationship with Lee Oswald. And the unique thing about Judith is she's one of the eyewitnesses who actually went to dinner with Lee Harvey Oswald and Jack Ruby. And there's multiple witnesses that have seen Jack Ruby with Lee Harvey Oswald on multiple occasions. They knew each other well. And there's another lie from the Warren Commission, because the Warren Commission said that there was no relationship whatsoever between Jack Ruby and Lee Harvey Oswald, which there's multiple witnesses that will tell you that's simply not true.
She also befriended Guy Bannister, the former head supervisor of the FBI in Chicago, who was in New Orleans. And at the time, and she and Oswald and Ruby had meetings together. And so he was a main character in this. He also was assassinated, met an untimely death under unusual circumstances. So we have a whole lot of people who were getting eliminated, who could not then testify. Sam Giancano, Johnny Roselli, Guy Bannister, David Ferry, Dorothy Kilgallen, William Pitzer, and Lee Bowers, and many others. It just, there's too many who knew each other, too many who are a piece of the puzzle. What I'm going to do is I'm going to, before we go to our summation questions with you, and I just want to let people know that you're listening to a special original in-depth investigative reporting series on the JFK assassination. And we are bringing in people from the thousands who have reported or written on the topic, who we believe are credible, and we have done months and months of research verifying facts, and we have some very original people, people you've not heard before, bringing pieces to this. For example, in this series, you have heard the lover of Lee Harvey Oswald. No one knew he had a lover. No one knew that that he and his wife had a planned a relationship in Russia. She tells a story about what he was really doing in Russia and that he had a handler in the CIA. She tells the story of how she was working in a secret lab for a agent that would kill Castro. And it was only when Lee Harvey Oswald arranged this meeting in Mexico City with a courier who was supposed to take the biological concoction that they had created back to Cuba, and he didn't show up. And then he had to leave quickly, but he had a cover story for everything. And she tells the truth of it. And she would be dead also. It wouldn't matter where she would have gone in the world. The thing is, nobody knew her maiden name. And as a result, and also one of the things, they misspelled her name. And so someone trying to track her would not have had an easy way of tracking her. But she disappeared immediately, and that's the reason that she was still alive. And she says Lee Harvey Oswald was a very cultured person and enjoyed many things nobody would have ever imagined, and spoke languages, read literature, classical literature, all the things that we were never told. We were told just the opposite. Anyhow, we're trying to present pieces to the puzzle, and it was only on the last day that all these pieces will come together, as you will see, and with some of the more interesting parts of that still to come. But right now we have Jesse Ventura, a former governor, on the line with us. And Jesse, I'm going to ask you to hold on, because I'm going to introduce someone. I don't know if you've ever spoken with Robert Morningstar or not, have you?
No, not directly. I have not.
Okay, well, Robert,
I don't recollect that I ever had. Maybe he'll correct me and say we have, but I don't think I have.
Because he will be able to provide some unique, original insights this audience has never heard on Tippit. He has done more analysis of the Kennedy autopsy photos. It was Robert Morningstar who did an analysis of the Zapruder film and showed me. I mean, the gestaltness is phenomenal. You see it, you think you see something, and then when he slows it down, and then when he freeze frames it, you actually see what he's talking about, how they cut this, how they edit it. And he'll go into that, but also he's going to give you some breaking news about physical evidence of shots from the grassy knoll based upon film analysis, looking for a vapor trail. As you know, every shot, the bullet that comes out has a certain velocity and creates a vapor, a heat signature. And he's going to talk about that and a few other things. For those of you who are just joining us, some of the stations you'll only be able to listen on your end for 1 hour. At the end of that hour, your station will go on to its next program. If you want to continue listening to the second hour today, where we'll be continuing with Robert Morningstar, and also we'll be talking with a gentleman who's got a lot of insights on the forensic evidence that has not been shared before, Vincent Palomara, especially what happened to Kennedy's autopsy. That'll be in the next hour. You can listen by telephone at 619-550-0869, 619-550-0869. Now we're going to put Jesse Ventura on hold for a moment because I think he would appreciate listening to this. Robert Morningstar, nice to have you with us today.
Thank you, Gary. It's a nice reunion.
Robert, let's go to two things that are absolutely important new information. Talk about the recent kill shot as it's based upon the vapor trails from gunshots on the grassy knoll in the Nix film.
Right. As some of your audience know, and you know very well, my theory of looking for vapor trails, condensation trails is a more accurate term, but vapor trail has become very popular because as a bullet, a high-velocity bullet, travels through the atmosphere, it's not only the heat, but more importantly, the drop in air pressure in as the bullet passes through the atmosphere creates a vacuum or a partial vacuum behind it. When the air pressure drops so radically, so quickly, molecules of water, what we call precipitation, they actually precipitate. They coagulate and create a cloud of vapor, and it remains in the atmosphere for a second or maybe more, depending on the atmospheric pressure. If there's high pressure, the air molecules come back together very quickly and push the water molecules apart. If the air pressure is low, then they'll linger for a little longer. So that's how this phenomenon works. When you see films on the History Channel of the Marianas Turkey Shoot, the Battle of the Philippine Sea, you will see the greatest compilation of this phenomenon in film that you will ever see. That said, let me say that I told Gary in 1992 of this theory, and I began to search for them. I found the most important vapor trail I found was in frame Z295 of the Zapruder film, as shown in the Oliver Stone movie. I refer to the movie JFK because Oliver Stone, like you, Gary, supported my work along with Zachary Sklar. You were the first people to know about it. And Oliver Stone allowed me to use the Cray supercomputer-enhanced version of the Zapruder film that he had made for the movie. And in that film at frame Z295, which is the point at which the president's car passes the lady in red, Jean Hill, whom I met personally and interviewed in Dallas, it passes Jean Hill and Beverly Oliver, both of whom I know, and I'm very honored to have known him. At that point, a bullet traverses over the president's head. It misses, it grazes the president's head, and then moves on cleanly right through Governor Connally. Governor Connally's wounds were not the result of a single bullet. He had a straight through the torso wound that hit several ribs. He had an entry wound in his wrist, the distal side of his wrist, which means the top of the wrist, which means the bullet came from the front. A British doctor made a presentation in Dallas 1998, and he pointed out, I read the report, he said, distal, this is this side of the wrist. If you see how he's holding his hat, it's impossible for a bullet that came through his body to have hit the back of his wrist. Just look at your wrist. Look at your palm. You're holding a hat. Turn it over. See if you can do it. You can't. And as a result, he concluded that the bullet that wounded Governor Connally in the wrist came from the front, went through his wrist, and deflected downward into his thigh. Another point, Chief Jesse Curry produced a book in the early 1990s, his collection of memorabilia from the JFK assassination. In it, he has a photograph of all the evidence that he sent to the FBI, including bullet fragments. Bullet fragments that came from Governor Connally. And when you take those bullet fragments and put them alongside the magic bullet, you will see that you have 1.5 bullets if they're all supposed to be the ones that went through President Kennedy and Governor Connally. So that debunks the magic bullet theory right there. Now, regarding the Nix film, everybody talks about the Zapruder film, but there were at least 6 films taken. The Nix film was taken across the street, directly across the street from Zapruder, and he had the panoramic view. He was not zoomed in. He was wide angle. He got everything from the sign to the grassy knoll and beyond. And in that film, which was very closely cropped, which, like the Zapruder film, was doctored, painted in, as I call it, Mickey Mouse. It's a cartoon. I consider the Zapruder film a cartoon of the assassination for reasons that you know very well. But we're on the Nix film. Now, the Nix film, in those early years, the 1990s, when it was released, when we could see it, I saw smoke in the upper corner. However, the film was so tightly cropped that these three little trails, I could not argue them with that much evidence, that little evidence. However, this year I came into possession of full-framed Nix film, and in that, not only do we get the 3 vapor trails that I sent to you yesterday, which, if you lay a ruler on these vapor trails, they go right to President Kennedy. Farther on, a few frames later, there's another single vapor trail, and you lay a ruler on this one, it goes right to President Kennedy's head. But in this particular frame, as I was concerned with the vapor trails, I noticed a radical alteration of Jackie's back, Jackie's hairdo, and in fact, Jack Kennedy's head. A brown line had been painted right straight through her neck and into President Kennedy's head, and then President Kennedy's head had been browned in, you know, like with a marker. And when I looked at it, I realized what I was seeing. They were the controllers, the manipulators, the fakers of the Nix film and the Zapruder film were so obsessed with covering up what is called the pink halo. The explosion of President Kennedy's head created a thing, an aura, that was witnessed and called. The little girl, Rosemary Willis, said, it looked like he had a pink halo. So it was so radically and horrifically depicted in the Nix film that they had to cover it up. But being so obsessed with covering up the pink halo, they completely missed the vapor trail, which is one thin little white line, and that's all it is. That's all a vapor trail is. And most people would take these vapor trails. Others have seen them, but have taken them for scratches on the film, because they linger for only one frame. So that is what I sent you yesterday. And this sounds the death knell of the magic bullet theory. And good riddance and goodbye to Arlen Specter. Mr. Ford is already gone.
And let's take a look at... By the way, if you remember at the time that you shared that information with me, I went down to Dallas, and based upon what you showed, mm-hmm. We did measurements, and those measurements showed that they were perfect alignment with the president in the motorcade. Now, let's go to one other question, that is Tippett, because you've probably done more research on Tippett's brain and x-rays than anyone else out here.
Yes.
Tell us what you have seen and can prove in a court of law with hard forensic evidence about Oswald killing Tippett, Tippett's autopsy, and the connection with Kennedy.
Okay. Well, Oswald did not kill Tippett. Oswald entered the movie theater, paid for his ticket, entered the movie theater around 1 o'clock, 1:05. Tippett was killed a few minutes later. There were two men involved in the Tippett killing. One was a stout man seen running in one direction, and one was a skinny man with a tan jacket running off in the other direction, who, as he emptied his gun, said, "A poor, dumb cop." He referred to Tippett as a poor, dumb cop. And that's exactly what he was. Tippett really was the getaway vehicle of the JFK assassination. And by that, I mean that his body was substituted for that of President Kennedy to present to the Warren Commission a brain that had actually been killed, a man who had actually been killed with a bullet one bullet through his brain. This was the most amazing discovery of my career. I knew Tippett's death from the day it happened. I read in the New York Times that Tippett had been shot in the eye and horribly disfigured and had been buried without a viewing of the body. No one was allowed to see his body, not his wife, not his family, no one. And he was quickly dispatched and buried very quickly. They say that today that Tippett was buried on Monday along with Oswald and President Kennedy. That's a misconception. Tippett was buried on Saturday the next day, and Jack Ruby was at his funeral. That's on film. CBS covered it. You can find Jack Ruby in the crowd. Jack Ruby and J.D. Tippett were really tight. Several of the witnesses, I would dare say the majority of the witnesses who were killed in the subsequent years, were people. I asked the question, why were these people killed? What were they talking about? I found that a lot of them were talking about the Tippett-Ruby connection, including a fellow named Hank Kellum. Hank Kellum's testimony was this: oh, I saw Tippett and Ruby riding around in their cruiser together. They sat so closely together in the front seat, you might have thought they were going out together. Okay? That's a quote. Now, Harrison Edward Livingston did a lot of work, and I'm drawing from vast resources of great researchers. David Lifton put me on this track about the brain. So I was told that Tippett was shot in the eye, and he was buried quickly. So then I was asked how was Tippett shot. So I said, oh, he was shot through the eye. But let me make sure. Jim Bishop's book, The Day Kennedy Was Shot, was right there within arm's reach. I picked it up, looked at the index, found Tippett, page so-and-so, went there and said Tippett was shot 4 times, 3 times in the torso, and once through the head. The bullet entered in the temporal region, traveled up through his brain, hit the back of his head, but did not exit. All right, right there. That was the epiphany. I said, it is impossible. I cannot believe. They're trying to make me believe that Oswald shot President Kennedy with a rifle from the sixth floor of the Texas School Book Depository, put a bullet in the back of his head that came out through the temporal region, and that 45 minutes later, he assassinates a police officer and shoots him 3 times. The man is dying in the street, shot in the chest and the torso. But the assassin walked over to him and supplied the coup de grace, the execution shot. But it wasn't just an ordinary execution shot. He kneeled down to Tippett on the ground, put the gun to his temple at the zygomatic process, this bone that connects your brow bone with your temporal bone, and he fired the single shot. And it went through his head at the angle that would hit the top of the head. It did not emerge. The back of the head photograph in the JFK assassination that shows the flap open and somebody holding the head by the hand, it purports to show an entry wound in the top of the head. Well, when you look closely at that wound, you find that the skin is not broken. You find that hair is growing out of the flesh that has sunken into the cavity or the depression. The bullet hit the back of the skull and chipped it and fell back into the brain, which necessitated that Dr. Earl Rose perform an autopsy to remove the bullet. Now get this. Earl Rose was the coroner, Dallas coroner, and he was fighting with the Secret Service over the theft of the body of President Kennedy. The theft of the body. That body should never have left Texas. It left Texas, hijacked by the Secret Service, under the orders of Lyndon Johnson. This fact was revealed for the first time to me last night on CNN News, which is rehashing the 1972 CBS
Robert, we're going to hold it there because we have another full hour to discuss this in greater depth and other insights on the JFK assassination. I just wanted to give a few tips on Tippett and also on the vapor trails that you've spent years, decades on,
yes,
and go back to former Governor Jesse Ventura for his closing thoughts so he can give us his his overview of this. And finally, Jesse, interesting insight, isn't it?
It's very interesting. You know, that's one of the things that really intrigues me about always following this murder and reading everything new I can get, is because it's very much like a jigsaw puzzle. And all these pieces are on the floor, and they're slowly assembled together. And can you complete the puzzle? No, you can't. But you can get enough pieces up there where you figure out what the puzzle is. And that's the great thing about it, is information continues even to this day. 50 years later, we stumble onto new information that leads us in directions to understand what happened that day.
In conclusion, you also agree with others such as James Tagg and Roger Stone that Lyndon Johnson was complicit in killing Kennedy. What is your perspective about how high up Johnson was on the ladder of ordering the assassination plot, and based on what evidence?
Well, you know, you can speculate. You can believe witnesses. Madeleine Brown, who was LBJ's mistress for over 20 years, and she actually bore him a child. We talk about it in my book, how there was a meeting that she said she went to the day before Kennedy was killed, where J. Edgar Hoover was there, and multiple Hunt and Murchison and all these oil men, and Lyndon Johnson and all them went into a room. And she said when Lyndon came out, he was all flushed and red in the face, and he came over and grabbed her by the wrist real hard and grumbled through his teeth, "After tomorrow, those Kennedy boys will never embarrass me again." Now, do you believe her or not? That's what it comes down to there. But if you do look at it from a strictly a homicide detective point of view, naturally you look at who gained the most, who in this murder, who profited the most, who likely, and that's what you do in any murder. And it comes up Lyndon Johnson completely, because he was neck deep in the Billy Saul Estes, Bobby Baker scandals in Texas. There was rumor that Kennedy was going to drop him from the ticket. He didn't need him anymore. So Lyndon Johnson obviously came out the best in the end over the death of John Kennedy. So naturally, he would have to be a prime suspect if you were legitimately doing a homicide investigation.
Well, we appreciate you adding your piece to this puzzle with the important work that you have done, both on your television series, Conspiracy Theory, as well as in the important book that you've written on this topic.
Well, thanks, Gary. Let me add this for a second. You know what I find ironic today? How they've morphed the word truth to have bad connotations to it now. Mm-hmm. Using the word truth, like if you're a truther, that means you're some sort of bad person. And I find that just ironic, that seeking the truth now, or attempting to learn the truth, can actually, our society's morphed it into evil. How can the truth ever be evil?
It can't, but it can be an inconvenience, especially at a time when they have morphed the idea of democracy and supplanted it with bureaucracy.
And okay. Well, I appreciate it, Gary. Thanks a lot. Keep up the great work, and we'll talk again someday, hopefully.
Thank you, Jesse.
All
Jesse
right,
Ventura,
bye-bye.
Author of the They Killed Our President, 63 Reasons to Believe There Was a Conspiracy to Assassinate JFK, Skyhorse Publisher. I'm Gary Knoll. Welcome you to this program. I'm Gary Knoll, and this is a continuation of our ongoing original in-depth investigative reporting series on the JFK assassination. We are adding pieces to the puzzle. Each one of these are based upon people who've supplied us, and we have reviewed documentation that could be presented into a court of law, distinguishing the differentiation between a person's subjective opinion versus hard prima facie evidence. In this hour, we're going to begin by listening to what Vincent Palomera has to say about the role and failures of the Secret Service, and also a look at the medical forensics following Kennedy's death. And he probably knows more about the Secret Service than anyone else involved in the Kennedy assassination, its history and its protocol. And he has interviewed over 80 former Secret Service agents and White House aides and surviving members of the Kennedy family. And from there, we will be completing the second half of our program with Robert Morningstar. He is a trained psychologist. He is a civilian intelligence and photo film analyst. And he is one of the most diligent of the researchers, because he has never given up on looking for the truth. So we'll have his look, and we're going to ask him about why he believes, or how he can prove, that the Zapruder film was altered. Who doctored it? Why? And give us the evidence. Now, I've seen the evidence. I've spent hour upon hour upon hour, 8 hours in one day, just reviewing the evidence in Robert's office. And sure enough, it's there. But it's not there by the naked eye. You won't see it until you're focused on it. Then you do see it. Then you have one of those aha moments. He's already given us his insights on Tippit's brain, and the X-rays to reinforce the magic bullet theory. And he's also the one who originated the vapor trails left by the gunfire from the grassy knoll, based upon the NIX film footage. So we'll go to him in the second part. Now let's say hello to Vincent Palomera and examine this virtually undiscussed part of the Kennedy assassination. Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Nall, and this is a special edition, an in-depth investigative reporting series on the JFK assassination. Today, the medical forensics following Kennedy's death. My guest in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, is Vince Palomera. Vince became interested in the JFK assassination at a young age. Vince's book, JFK, The Medical Evidence Reference, is regarded as one of the most thorough texts on the physical examination of the medical forensics and cover-up following Kennedy's death. His website is vincepalomera.blogspot.com. Nice to have you with us today, Vince.
Oh, great to be here, Gary. Thanks to you and thanks to your audience.
Now we go from the hard prima facie evidence that you presented from years of really good research, Vincent, to where we have to go now, and that is the forensic evidence.
Okay.
I want you to take apart the official explanation that the mainstream media, including those on the left — I'm just appalled by the Keith Urbans and Rich Maddows and others who don't believe in any of this. They still believe in the lone gunman, and they have the resources, certainly.
Right.
They could hire the staff to do the follow-up of anyone else's original investigation, but no one in the media has followed up on this. I want you to show what I became aware of a long time ago.
Mm-hmm.
And the person that showed me the original evidence that absolutely destroyed the official Warren report was Robert Morningstar.
Oh, yeah. Much aware of him, yeah. Mm-hmm.
It was Robert, by the way, who found the following. And then I went down to Daily Plaza, and we did the measurements, and we found it was correct. That the Zapruder film does one good thing for us. Yes, it was edited in several places. Because in one second you see the flag going out, and the next second you see the flag hanging down on the car. That could only have happened because it was a reduction in speed at that moment. That's the kill shot.
Yes.
But what they didn't know at that time in 1963 is that every bullet creates a unique and specific heat pattern. The velocity of the caliber, when it's shooting through the air, it creates a vapor stream. Under infrared, you can actually see this. So putting the Zapruder film through an infrared scan, you suddenly see these tracer lines. Those are the actual bullets that were being fired. We then went down and took a blow up, an enhancement photograph in my studios, because we have a full editing studio here.
Mm-hmm.
And we saw something in a tree, and it matched one of these lines. That was a marksman's a bag. It looks about the size of a tea bag. And if you're trying to have your shot aligned with your target, you put something in line so when you're moving your rifle, the moment your scope hits that bag, you fire, goes through there. That in effect, it was helping them to align to a kill shot. The lasers, the tracers, the infrared tracers, show that there were not three bullets fired. There were multiple more bullets fired, including coming from the picket fence, the grassy knoll, not just in the depository building, but another building beside that. So that was one thing. Separately, there was the unique episode of Lee Harvey Oswald allegedly killing Tippit and the police officer. But then what he did was just really unbelievable. Through thousands of hours, he was able to show that since there were no actual photographs at the time presented of the autopsy, but rather sketches, he was able to show that it was actually Tippit and the Tippit's skull that was and scalp that was being used as a model, since he was very similar to JFK, same bone structure. And anyhow, I won't get into that at this moment. That's a topic for a discussion with Robert, because he's the one who uncovered that.
Yeah, he's amazing. Yeah, I've seen some of his stuff, yeah.
He is quite simply one of the most phenomenal scholars on JFK in the United States, and I've known him for 25 years. So take us through why the official forensic evidence was all falsified. None of it could have been real. The people who have decried it, the people who have deconstructed it, take us through that now.
Okay. Well, again, I'm talking about, you know, my interest in the Secret Service. This is very germane because the Secret Service had access to the body of the president at Parkland. They stole it away from the officials. Back then, the shooting of a president was not a federal crime. It was a local crime. They had no jurisdiction yet. They stole the body away. It goes to a military autopsy at Bethesda, and they have control of the x-rays and the photographs. Bottom line is this. Many of the people that were witnesses in Dealey Plaza, many of the Parkland Hospital doctors and nurses, and many of the people at Bethesda during the autopsy said that the right rear of the president's head was missing. Again, that right there is prima facie evidence of conspiracy, because, once again, entrance holes are small, exit wounds are large. If you have the majority of witnesses saying the right rear of the president's head's gone, as Clint Hill keeps saying over and over again on TV on his book tour here, they don't realize what that means, or maybe they do, and they just can't connect the dots. I don't know what that means to them, but what it means to the average person that studies it is obviously he was shot from the front. You see this Zapruder film, he's flying back and to the left, as we know the manager from the JFK movie, definitely shot from the front. Not denying he was not also shot from the rear, but he was definitely shot in the cross thigh. That's the bottom line there. Now, this is amazing. Speaking of another discovery in 1991, Dr. Robert Shaw was Governor Connally's chief surgeon, and a television audience of many millions of people, he did a little press conference, a little recap of Governor Connally's surgery. And he mentioned matter-of-factly, and this is on YouTube, I posted it, that the bullet was still in the leg of the governor. It had not been removed yet. It'll be removed when he gets out of general anesthesia. It's not a major concern. And the reporters asked again, the bullet's still in the leg? Yes, the bullet's still in the leg, left thigh. And this is several hours after the so-called magic bullet is allegedly found on a stretcher, and supposedly the Secret Service agent Richard Johnson has it in his pocket on Air Force One going back to Washington. They turn it over to the FBI, and beyond all the well-known problems with the single bullet theory, the trajectory as well as the condition of the bullet, we can stop all that because several hours later, again, before a television audience of many millions of people, the surgeon is saying the bullet, several, not a fragment, not semantics, the bullet is still in the leg, left thigh. One of the reporters also said, what's the caliber of the bullet? He didn't know. Again, because the bullet was still in the thigh. It'll be removed when he gets out of general surgery. Another major smoking gun, no doubt about it, because that just blows away the whole official fiction right there. How could it be in Richard Johnson's pocket on Air Force One when at the same time still in the governor's leg? makes no sense whatsoever. And then you can get into the whole thing about, you know, many of the witnesses thought shots came from the front. The smell of gunpowder on the street and the witnesses that said smoke came from the knoll. So just the smell of gunpowder alone, how could it have been street level that soon after the shooting? Allegedly Oswald on a sixth-floor perch, how could the smoke have got down there that soon? And obviously the witnesses actually saw smoke as well. And then you get into the whole thing about the back wound of President Kennedy, the FBI agents that were there, so the and also Bethesda witnesses like Gerald Custer and Paul O'Connor and others that were x-ray technicians and just general, you know, they helped the autopsy doctors, Humes, Boswell, and Fink, said that that back wound did not penetrate to the neck. It didn't go anywhere in the neck. It was on the back. It only penetrated about an inch or two, and it stopped. It didn't go anywhere. And the doctors were told, ordered, not to dissect the neck wound. The neck wound that came out, Pierre Fink, during the Garrison trial, said, yeah, it was admirals, it was generals. And when you're just a lieutenant colonel in the Army, you follow orders. And he would just hem and haw, would not come out and admit who the person was. He said, I don't remember who it was. It was one of the many generals in the room. And now it's coming out that General Curtis LeMay very well could have been in that gallery in the autopsy. He hated Kennedy, wanted us to blow Cuba and Vietnam back to the Stone Age. And yet he's there at the autopsy, and many people have wondered if he could have been one of the many generals that was really calling the shots, no pun intended, there in the autopsy. And just all the, you know, like Bill Greer and Roy Kellerman, the two agents that were in the presidential limousine, they also said the right rear of the president's head was missing, and Bill Greer never, in private interviews, and even to the House Select Committee, it came out in the late 1990s, the documents, he could never understand the single bullet theory. He said, well, that was the Warren Commission. You know, they had a lawyer working on that. That was their thesis on the whole matter. So even when you get down to some of these individual witnesses that were there, sometimes they don't realize the weight of the evidence of what they're saying, what that means. It goes against official history. But just to make a long story short, the consensus seems to be the back of the president's head was gone. You look at the official photos and x-rays, the back of the head's intact. That cannot be. How can all these witnesses of Bethesda and Parkland say this? Something's wrong. Something's wrong with the photos and x-rays. Then you get into the trajectory of the magic bullet, but you get beyond that. The Secret Service had custody of all these pieces of evidence, the magic bullet, the pieces of skull, the president's clothing, the x-rays and the photos, the actual presidential limousine itself, you know, obviously the president's body, TV recordings of Parkland doctors, hospital statements. They spoke afterwards. Dr. Malcolm Perry said that the wound in the front appeared to be coming at him, appeared to be an entrance wound, and they said about the right posterior of the president's head was missing. Well, then, lo and behold, the transcripts and the video were all missing until a transcript shows up at the LBJ library, and someone uncovers that. Thank God there's some sort of trail. But the Secret Service confiscated all that. They had the first reenactments and surveys. They had possession of all the major assassination photos and films. They interviewed the Texas School Book Depository employees. There's a gentleman by the name of Elmer Moore, Agent Elmer Moore, who really bears heavy guilt in what happened afterwards, the cover-up. He went to Parkland and cajoled some of the Parkland doctors to change their tune. And he even admitted to a medical student in the late 70s, James Galchner, that he felt bad for bullying Dr. Perry about the direction of the bullet. But at the same time, he said, well, Kennedy was a traitor, you know, it was good for the country. It was a bad thing to happen. Maybe it was a good thing at the same time. And he said, we did what we were ordered to do. We'd get our heads cut off if we didn't. I had to go there. I had to do what I had to do. And obviously, that looms large for the official fiction. You had an agent several days after the assassination going down there, bullying the doctors to change their tune in line with the so-called official autopsy. He has regrets about it, but at the same time, out of the side of his mouth, he's saying, well, Kennedy was a traitor. You know, he's selling out to the communists. And again, it gets down to motive. You have these agents that several of them harbored ill will toward the president for his personal life and his views on national security issues, Cuba, Vietnam. All it takes is a little action through an action. And for these gentlemen to harbor these kind of views in and of itself is disturbing. When you realize they're there to protect the president, they didn't. Then they had all the primary physical evidence, and there's a lot of problems with the chain of possession of that evidence and the problems with the evidence just on its own with the directionality of the shots and whatnot. But what's so nauseating to me is when you turn on television now for the 50th anniversary programs, and they all invariably trot out the Oswald did it, magic bullet, trying to put a square peg in a round hole, and they don't go through the things we're talking about because they don't want to go through it. They just want to wrap this up and say, it was Oswald, that's it, it's 50th anniversary, that's it, and it's obscene. Thank God for the work of many authors and researchers, even years before I was around. And I'm just glad they were there to do the pioneering work and a lot of the amazing books that have come out in the last 5-10 years, because it's really laid out for future historians and just anybody who's interested that there's no doubt it's not a
Vincent,
yeah.
We only have a few moments left. Mm-hmm. I want you to stick right on point here.
Okay.
We all are aware, this audience is aware of the negligence and malfeasance of the media. What we're interested in is what can we learn that's new? You've given us at least 24 separate pieces of information today that most people were unaware of, and that put together start to form a mosaic that's very disturbing. Take us through anything else that you can think of, including the other forensic physicians, the pathologists who came in later, examining the evidence of the autopsy reports and
okay.
the Warren Commission, and how they completely deconstruct them, showing they were all lies. And yet these people were given no attention.
Okay, well, you know, I was talking about Sam Kinney before. He had the piece of the back of the president's head on the C-130 transport plane with the presidential limousines going back to Dallas. He told me, I had the answer all these years. People were talking about this incredible missing piece of the back of the president's head. I had the answer all these years, but no one's called me. And this is me talking to him in 1994. The gentleman passes away in 1997. He told me he only had one interview on TV, only one and only interview. They just wanted to talk about John, nothing about the details of the case. And here's the guy who had the back part of the president's head. It was in the back of a limousine on the C-130. He puts a phone patch into Dr. Berkeley, the president's personal physician. He doesn't know whatever became of the skull fragment. We would like to know, too, because there's all this problems with the skull fragments. Normally, they're only considered much smaller, and we don't know if it's one, two, three pieces. We can't get the orientation right. The Harper fragment that was found in Dealey Plaza, the initial doctors who viewed it and photographed it said it was from the occipital area, which is in the back of the head, and yet that piece is missing. Only some photographs luckily survived, but even those are open to interpretation. See how the government can do that. They could say, oh, it's a photograph. We don't have the original piece, how that works. But with Sam Kinney's eyewitness account of what happened on the street in Elm Street, Dealey Plaza, and actually having that back piece of the president's head, that's just amazing. But again, he said, like you said, I had the answer all these years, and no one called me. On a side note, I spoke to a lot of the doctors and nurses in Parkland Hospital and Bethesda. In fact, one of them, Gerald Custer, who passed away in 2000, was the x-ray technician there at Bethesda. He adamantly believed that there was a conspiracy to take the president's life and the shots came from the front. He joined the litany of many people that believe the back of the president's head was missing. He made an extra set of the x-rays and hid them, and he was hoping that one day that maybe this could be, explosive evidence, because he knew something was wrong. But then he said he regretted one thing he did after he did that to make an extra set. He ended up destroying them because he was worried about going to jail, facing federal charges because of the gag order not to talk. So that's his one big regret. He actually made an extra set of the x-rays and hid them. And obviously people like Dr. Mantic, who studied the x-rays, and other people, Dr. Aguilar, said that would have been a gold mine, because many people think the photos and x-rays have been tampered with. At the very least, they've been tampered with as far as the perspective, the way they were purposely photographed and x-rayed a certain way to avoid certain structures and whatnot, so we can't get a proper orientation, and it can be a quote-unquote open to interpretation, being purposely vague. And so that's what you get. And as far as the other people at Parkland and Bethesda, I spoke to Dr. William Zedlitz, and this gentleman is very unknown, to put it mildly. He's mentioned just one time in the Warren Commission volumes. Dr. White mentions one of the doctors is there. He misspelled the gentleman's name, so all these years no one knew how to contact him. He called him Dr. William Zedlitz when it's William Zedlitz with that extra E. Well, back in 1998, just on a random hunt, I found the guy, and I wrote to him. He said, yeah, you're the first person to ever contact me. No one's ever contacted me before. And he gave me his story, and he joined the course of all his colleagues. Matter of fact, he's saying the right rear of the president's head was missing, and he believed that one of the shots came from the front. But this is the government for it. They spent millions of dollars on the High Select Committee. Lord knows how much money during the Warren Commission, all these so-called investigators, and little old me with a stamp and a telephone got more information there than these guys with their budgets and whatnot, subpoena power. And again, this gentleman corroborated all his colleagues. You know, Dr. Crenshaw came out with his major book in 1992. He was there at Parkland. Again, he espoused the shots came from the front and whatnot. And many, and he was left out to dry, but some people in the media said, oh, how do we know Dr. Crenshaw was even there and all this slanderous accusations? He was corroborated by his colleagues, but they didn't want to get into that. They wanted to, you know, squelch this because they realized what was going. The media does not want to talk about the true story of the president's wounds because there's no way to get around that. They love when people deal in theories because they can shoot them down and say, well, that's a speculation. But when you get into the hard medical evidence, the people that are actually there, there's no way you can denigrate that. If it's one person, maybe, but when it's a course of, you know, trained medical people at Bethesda and Parkland, it's all the president's wounds firsthand. They were there. They're not looking at photos and x-rays. They were actually there with the body. That's one thing they have of all the other investigations. That all these other investigations, they just have the photos and x-rays after the fact. They don't have the actual body, and that's the advantage they will always have over any other investigation, is they had prime look at everything. They were there. And that's where we're at now. Douglas Horn came out with a five-volume series inside the ARB that I had I helped with in certain respects. And his book is tremendous at the medical evidence. He actually, in the late 90s, got some of the autopsy doctors and x-ray technicians and whatnot under oath. And, again, what they said, they didn't realize the weight of what they had to say compared to the official fiction, because they were saying that, yeah, the occipital area was missing, and we don't know what happened to this x-ray. There should have been this x-ray of the chest cavity. I don't know what happened to it, and that's what we're left with now. You know, only a select few people can look at the autopsy x-rays and photos in the National Archives. They have to be approved by some member of the Kennedy family, and we don't have access to that. Only bootlegs have reached the public. But I think it's just high time that the president's body was exhumed, and I think it's high time that the photos and x-rays in toto were made available to the American public. And it's not for the gruesome aspects of
Vince,
it. From a forensic
Vince,
standpoint.
I only have one last question, because we're running up against our time here.
Yeah.
All of this that you're telling us could only have happened if someone, the highest levels of the Secret Service, so ordered it. So if we're to presume that the information you are sharing with us is based upon an intent to kill the president and not merely these people making a series of tremendous blunders in judgment, then who would have been in a position to have done that? And do you have any evidence, real evidence, not speculation, that could give us a better picture of who that would have been?
Well, I'm in line with St. John Hunt, E. Howard Hunt's son. I definitely believe that it was the Vice President Lyndon Johnson in concert with David Attlee Phillips of the CIA and Cord Meyer of the CIA, that they were the leading lights in the conspiracy to kill the president. Now, as far as what I have, apart from what these gentlemen like St. John Hunt and other authors and researchers have on that, is that Emory Roberts, that gentleman I mentioned before, who was the shift leader in charge of the follow-up car of the agents and who recalled all those agents at La Field during the assassination, et cetera. He benefited in a very unique way after the assassination. The Secret Service has been around since 1865. They're apolitical. They're not Democratic or Republic. They're supposed to work for the Treasury Department now, the Office of Homeland Security. At the same time he was a Secret Service agent, he was appointment secretary to Lyndon Johnson.
Okay.
That is outrageous. That is unheard of. That is unprecedented. That's never happened before. That's never happened since.
Vince, unfortunately, we're out of time, but you've given us plenty of information, and we thank you very much for sharing your insights with us.
Oh, thank you. Thanks a lot.
Vince Palamara, Palamara. I'm Gary Nall. Thank you all for listening to this continuation. And now let's go back in to this last part of our interview today with Robert Morningstar. If you just joined us, Robert Morningstar has been breaking some important new insights about the shots from the grassy knoll based upon a film analysis looking for vapor trails, but he also is one of the experts on the autopsy, or the alleged autopsy. Nice to have you with us again, Robert.
Thank you, Gary.
Robert, take us step by step through Tippett's brain, why Tippit was selected, in your opinion, what we know about Tippit, and then how can they justify, with all these firsthand accounts from medical doctors and nurses and people both in Dallas and also in Bethesda, showing that the back of his head was blown off, and then we're led to believe that there was only one shot, and it came from the kill shot that came from the back, when all these other people say there's an entry wound in the front, which is smaller, and the blowout, the larger exit in the back. Take us through each part of this, all right?
Okay. Well, the answer, the general answer to your question is quite simple. The conclusion was reached before the investigation was made. And in order for, and that's the postulation of the magic bullet theory. So with regard to the Zapruder film had to be altered to make it fit the magic bullet theory, and that's why about 10 feet of film has been removed from it. With regard to Tippit, President Kennedy was shot from the front, from the back, from street level, and from a high building, not the Texas School Book Depository, but the County Records Building. I would like to say that there is one mass media station trying to squeeze out the truth, and that is Fox News and Bill Hemmer, who produced the best documentary to date on the JFK assassination. I've been feeding them information for a long time. It finally registered, and they did a computer rendering of the shot that you described earlier. Remember the vapor trail that you took the solid copy? They took that information, they put it into a computer, and they registered, they animated this actual shot. And I predicted, I said in 1994 when I went to Dallas and stood there with that same photograph that I gave you, I said, impossible, this couldn't have come from the Texas School Book Depository. It had to have come from the County Records Building. And what is the County Records Building? That's where the sheriff's office is. So the collusion in the murder of President Kennedy involves several hate groups. It was a convention of hatred in Dallas. Everyone who hated President Kennedy had a representative there. The key was to kill the president with multiple shooters and get away with it, and postulating a single patsy did it. Okay? So in order to do that, they foresaw that not only would they have to control all the witnesses and all the information, local information, all the films. Many films were confiscated by a man, ironically, an FBI agent named Regis Kennedy, confiscated films and cameras, including a film taken by the lady in white, Beverly Oliver, whom I met personally in 94, 96 in Dallas. So the Tippit angle. Tippit was a rogue cop. He was a buddy-buddy of the local mafioso, Jack Ruby. Jack Ruby ran heroin. He ran guns. Jack Ruby worked for Richard Nixon since 1947 as an informant. He had FBI protection through the 1950s and 60s. Ruby ran guns to Castro when we thought he would be on our side. Ruby ran guns to the anti-Castro factions after Castro turned. So to get away with it, you had to provide medical evidence that one shooter killed the man. Officer Tippit was lured into a trap. He thought that he was going to go out and kill the man who killed the president, and that he was going to be the big hero. Unfortunately, Mr. Tippit bore such a close resemblance to President Kennedy that his friends on the Dallas Police Department used to rib him and call him Jack and JFK. Now, those were not nice names to be called in Dallas in 1963. So this was information. When I first mentioned this possibility of the Tippit JFK body swap, photo swap, brain swap, everybody laughed in Chicago. Not everybody. Half the audience of 200 of the top researchers in the world heard me ask questions about Tippit and suggest that his brain had been used. Little did I know that it was his whole body and all of his photographs. At the time, I just discovered a brain with one bullet through the head, and logic said to me, this is it. President Kennedy's brain, or very little of it, remained. Less than half of his brain remained. Yet the weight of the brain, or the volume of the brain described in the Warren Commission report, is 1,500 cc's. The average human brain is 1,200 cc's. So the brain that they had in Bethesda, in which they autopsied, was about the size of a good-sized dolphin. Well, brains don't grow, you know. Brains don't grow back after they've been liquefied and obliterated and turned into vapor. So how is it possible? Well, Tippett's brain was removed by Earl Rose after removing the bullet that had lodged in it. And to preserve it, the brain was put into formaldehyde. And as you know, when tissue absorbs liquid, it swells up. So that's my explanation of the 1,500 cc volume. More importantly, the description of the wounds that I read in the Kennedy autopsy report, the Warren Commission report, are paraphrases of the brain described by Dr. Earl Rose. Describes the severance of the same internal parts of the brain, like laceration of the hypothalamus. The trajectory described is the same. Now, here's the really strange thing I found about the Tippett autopsy and the Tippett murder in general. Tippett was killed about 1:15 in the afternoon, and Oswald was in the theater at about 1 o'clock, 1:05. Out of nowhere, this is not the age of cell phones and public telephones on every corner of a Dallas suburb, which is what 10th and Patton is. But out of nowhere, 5 minutes later, an ambulance appears, takes Tippett's body. Tippett's body disappears for an hour. I've been able to track down where it went, which was he went to Methodist Hospital. And at Methodist Hospital at 2:30 in the afternoon, he was declared dead by Judge Joe Brown. Joe Brown calls for an autopsy. The body is taken from Methodist Hospital to Parkland Hospital. And in Parkland Hospital, imagine this, in Parkland Hospital, now the Judge Brown's signature is time stamped at 2:30 in the afternoon. It takes time to get from Methodist to Parkland. I don't think they could have done it in 10 minutes. Maybe they could. Be that as it may, let's give them 10 minutes. Okay, 2:30, 2:40. By 3:15 in the afternoon, Tippett's autopsy was completed. Signed, sealed, delivered. Signed by Dr. Earl Rose, November 22nd, 1963, 3:15 in the afternoon. I think that's impossible. Literally impossible. You cannot cut open a body, do a Y section, open it up, look at the internal organs, the lungs, the kidneys, and so on, and the brain in 40 minutes. Okay, so that's one discrepancy. So I thought at this time that what my discovery was, I had found the brain that had been used to prove the single bullet theory, because it was true. That brain had been killed with one bullet through the head. Little did I realize, as I looked for more and more photographs of Tippett, because that was the hardest photograph to find in all the Kennedy assassination realm, there had only been one picture of Tippett released since 1963, showing a man about 26 years old with wavy black hair, a cowboy shirt, a tilted head, and kind of looking like Elvis Presley. So I dubbed that picture the Tippett Elvis picture. So I began a 2-year search for other photographs of Tippett, and little by little, one came in. Richard Corey, the son of Professor Irwin Corey, he's a very big investigator in this field, had a lot of material, and he had a picture of Tippett that he gave to me, and that's when I saw it. I said, oh my God, not only did his brain used, I realized that's Tippett in the JFK photographs, because when I saw the first autopsy photo in David Lifton's book, I looked at the photo and I said, that doesn't look like JFK in 1963. He looks too young. It looks more like Kennedy, in 1950. Well, Tippett was about 39 years old And Kennedy was 47 when he died. So the age discrepancy. But the final, the clincher, you might say, was that I saw really dark moles on the victim's neck. In those photographs, if you look at the purported photos of President Kennedy, you will find black moles on the neck, and you'll find a black mole on top of the left ear. The teeth are not exactly the same. Tippett had more buck teeth than Kennedy. They both had big teeth, strong jaws, high cheekbones. They're slightly different in the nose. President Kennedy's nose was a little rounder, and Tippett's nose was very, very sharp and straight. But, you know, they didn't expect the public to see these pictures. They were hidden within the Warren Commission. To my knowledge, only Arlen Specter got to see the photographs in detail. He opened them up and looked them over. And only Earl Warren got a glimpse of them, of the actual commissioners. But he opened up the envelope, took one look at them, and he just threw them back in. He said, I don't want to look at that. Because they are gruesome. And they're intentionally gruesome to make you look away. They make you... Even the Gestalt is used in the autopsy photographs. They've been doctored, too. The color ones, called the devil's ear. This flap of skin that's open on the side of the victim. And I recognize that as the flap that Earl Rose had to cut into the head in order to track the bullet in Tippett's brain and remove it. Another thing, when Humes, Boswell, and Fink took the body, received the body in Bethesda, when one of the doctors reached in to get the brain, he was shocked. He said, it just popped out. What a surprise. He took it. Now, the brain is attached by membranes to the skull, you know. So, and I have done work in college, you know, with specimens and removing brains and things like that. And it was really a tough job because the membrane is thick. It's like a glue. It sticks to the bone. Well, this brain just popped out. Those were his words. He said it just popped out. I think it was Humes. So there's a discrepancy. I met Paul O'Connor, who removed the body from the metal casket. Paul O'Connor's description of how they opened the body is completely at variance with the Warren Commission report. The Warren Commission report refers to a Y incision in the torso, which is cutting basically up the abdomen from the pubic bone to the sternum and then opening it up with a Y across the chest. Paul O'Connor, a man who was dying of cancer, I met him November 22nd, 1998. I sat down with him for an hour. He was a very angry man. And he said to me, that's all BS. There was no Y incision. We, Gerald Koster and I, opened up that body with an electric saw. And he described it to me. He put his fingers on his right hip. He said, we started right above the hip bone. We cut up right through the ribs, up to the clavicle. We cut across the clavicle. We came down the left side of the ribs back down to the same point just above the hip. Then we took the whole chest and we pulled it up and pulled it down like a goddamn horse blanket. Those were his very words. Okay, so there, the man who took the body out of the metal casket. Now, what body is this? What metal casket? It turns out that there were two deliveries to Bethesda. Dennis David, Commander Dennis David, United States Navy, Gerald Koster, and Paul O'Connor were corpsmen. They were called to the back of Bethesda Naval Hospital to receiving bay. And an ambulance came in. They removed a metal casket, which was, to them, President Kennedy's body. They took it upstairs, left it on the 8th floor, because it was that's where the autopsy was supposed to happen. So then they went downstairs, and on the second floor gallery, Dennis David stood as he watched Jackie Kennedy, Robert Kennedy, and the motorcade arrive, and the second coffin arriving. Admiral Galloway, United States Navy, walked over to that station wagon. He got in the driver's seat, and he drove away. He did not go to the back of the hospital where the body was to be delivered. He raced around, being chased by the honor guard, for nearly half an hour, and all around the Bethesda grounds. And the Marine Honor Guard, who was there to honor the president's body, kept running after the station wagon here and there and there. And finally he came around, and that coffin was delivered. Dennis David swears he was standing on the second floor gallery watching Jackie come in and the ambulance arrive 15 minutes after he'd taken the metal casket upstairs and opened it up and seen the body. Okay, so that's the background of what happened in Bethesda. And Bethesda is a very sinister place, folks. Bethesda is named after a very beautiful myth, the well at Bethesda where the angel stirred the waters and the first people to touch the water would be healed. Unfortunately, that's quite the opposite. Bethesda was instituted to keep military secrets. After World War II, Bethesda Naval Hospital was needed because hundreds of thousands of soldiers were coming back with top-secret information. And that top-secret information had to be sealed inside their heads. And that was the purpose of Bethesda. It was the place where they were debriefed, they were coerced, they were drugged, their memories were erased. And that's this is Bethesda Naval Hospital. This is where Admiral Byrd was kept in jail for 5 days. I call it. He was kept in jail, incommunicado, after he came back from Antarctica. This is the place where James Forrestal went out the window. Folks, there were no bed sheets at Bethesda. There were no bed sheets tied together trying to go out the window. He did not go out his bedroom window. He was thrown out the galley window. The bedroom window was too small. Bethesda is the site of very sinister events, including the murder of Commander Pitzer. Commander Pitzer had taken 16-millimeter film of the autopsy, and he knew what happened. He was a loyal Navy officer. President Kennedy was a loyal Navy officer, a member of the Office of Naval Intelligence. Pitzer was going to go public. His mistake was stating that he was going to go public. He made a copy of his film. He was planning to retire, or circa 1965, I believe. And then he said, he told people, I'm going to break this story. I'm going to leak it. I'm talking to NBC News. And that got him killed. Pitzer was found at his death with a gun in his hand, shot through the right side of the head. Commander Pitzer was a left-handed man. Vincent Palmera, I'm happy to be on the program with him because he wrote an essay, an article. It was called 57 Witnesses to the JFK Assassination. And as I mentioned before, a large number of the people who died in the aftermath of the Kennedy assassination were people who knew about the Jack Ruby Tippit connection, including Dorothy Kilgallen. Dorothy Kilgallen had not only notes, she had a huge number of photographs, which she kept in a folder. And she appeared on a TV program called Nightline at that time. And she told the host about it. He said to her, please, please don't take out those photographs and please don't show them on the show. So she went on the show. She respected his wishes, put the folder on her lap, and then she did the show and said that she was going to blow the JFK Kennedy murder case right out of the water. And those notes disappeared, the photos disappeared, but I can tell you, Dorothy Kilgallen was one of the greatest investigative reporters this country has ever produced. She was in Dallas the year immediately after the assassination and right through the trial. She discovered the things that I am telling you today, and she died for it. She was found unconscious, dressed with makeup, in the wrong bed, with a book she'd already read, and the medical examiner's findings on her autopsy were kept sealed for 20 years. Lee Israel wrote a book about Dorothy Kilgallen and finally revealed that they found 3 types of barbiturates mixed with alcohol in her stomach. A lethal compound. And that's what killed her. Dorothy Kilgallen spoke to Marilyn Monroe on the night before Marilyn Monroe was killed. And they discussed her affair with President Kennedy and several other topics, which I will leave for another day. And there is a memo that is an FBI memo reporting the conversation with a CC, a carbon copy, to General James Shulgin, who was the United States Air Force liaison to the FBI at that time in a particular field of research that we don't have to go into today. Tippett, poor Mr. Tippett, he thought he was going to be a hero, and he was only set up by the mafia. Let that be a lesson to any rogue cops. Dirty cops are one of the worst things we suffer in this country. And I think that Tippett's story should be brought out more publicly to warn police officers to stay clean.
That's a separate issue.
Yes, sir.
Let's get back to some of the, because we only have 10 minutes to go.
Okay.
I'd like for you to give us more details on the following. You have a lot of information on JFK's mistress. She had a lot to say. I'd like for you to tell us what you know, or at least can substantiate. Not rumor, not hearsay. I want good evidence.
Which mistress? Which one?
Oh, yeah, he had seven that I know of. Okay. But let's talk.
Okay.
So let's do the following. Let's take a look at JFK, what you know about him. Whatever evidence you have that can tie him to the assassination, share that with us. And any of the other players that you can tie in, including J. Edgar Hoover.
Okay. Well, when you say the word mistress, there, he did have many. Two come most quickly to my mind. Mary Meyer, who was a CIA employee, and Judith Exner Campbell, who was Sam Giancana's mistress. So, Mary Meyer was the wife of Cord Meyer. Cord Meyer was the head of MKUltra. MKUltra was the mind control apparatus of the Central Intelligence Agency. And as you know, the Zapruder film is doctored, but not in any ordinary way. It's doctored using Gestalt psychology, which is the psychology of human perception. Gestalt psychology discovered how a human being creates a thought by organizing visual information. And from that visual information or organization creates an idea, a perception. Our perceptions have been manipulated every time anyone looks at the Zapruder film and thinks that's what happened in Dealey Plaza. They're under mind control. Cord Meyer was the head of the mind control apparatus of the CIA.
Mary Meyer was married to him.
She was married to him, but...
And they got divorced.
And... I'm not sure they were divorced at that time. But let me tell you this. They had known each other since the 1940s. Kennedy and Cord Meyer had vied for Mary Pinchot's affections. And back in 1945 and 1946, they were both wooing her. But Mary Meyer chose to go and marry Cord Meyer, who was, you know, higher up. Well, Kennedy was not high up in the social strata. Cord Meyer was. He was old WASP. You know what I mean? It was a Protestant Catholic dichotomy. So there was.
You know what I want to do? I want to shift gears.
Sure.
I want to. Let's talk about Lyndon Johnson. Do you have any?
Oh,
evidence?
I have something wonderful for you.
Tell us, Lyndon Johnson.
Truth is wonderful.
Yes.
Sure.
Go ahead.
Okay. The organization in the CIA that killed President Kennedy was something called the 5412 Committee. Our wonderful friend, our late friend, Fletcher Prouty, used to tell you about the secret team, but he never gave you the name. The name of the secret team is the 5412 Committee. This was the assassination apparatus set up in the 1950s by the CIA to get rid of undesirable politicians by assassination. And they didn't happen just in Latin America. There were assassinations in Greece, in France, in Italy during those years to stop the onslaught of communist takeover of those countries. This committee and this information I'm giving to you now comes directly from the Church Committee, the House Select Committee on Assassinations. They put it out. The organization was formed like this. There was the Special Operations Group of the CIA. That molted into something called the 10-2 Committee, which is the October 5th Committee, and the October 20 Committee. These were euphemisms for an executive committee. Executive in the term of execute. It molted into the 54-12 committee during the middle of the Eisenhower administration. And to keep the president in the dark with plausible deniability, the president was not told about it. And the directorate of the 54-12 committee, the assassination apparatus, devolved to the vice president of the United States, Richard Nixon. So Richard Nixon, with the 54-12 committee and the CIA, were the people who were organizing the plots on Castro. Johnny Roselli was recruited through Robert Mayhew to facilitate a liaison with the mafia. Roselli, thinking he was being patriotic and happy to have the protection, as he thought, of the U.S. government, got Sam Giancana and Santos Trafficante on board. He went to Sam Giancana. Sam said, well, Miami and Cuba are Santos Trafficante's territory. We have to talk to him. On September 25th, 1959, Sheffield Edwards of the counterintelligence and the CIA's internal security agency, you know, like internal affairs, they delegated him to meet with Giancana and Trafficante and Roselli, and the deal was made. Shortly thereafter, $10,000 was given through Roselli to them to start the wheels turning to kill Castro. And as I said, the director of this was Richard Nixon. Richard Nixon expected to win the election in 1960. We all know the election was stolen in Chicago by Sam Giancana and his henchmen on behalf of President Kennedy. And so, ironically, Kennedy wins the election, Nixon loses, and who becomes the director of the 54-12 committee without the knowledge of the president? Lyndon Johnson inherited the assassination apparatus that he would later use to become president of the United States. And there you have it. The paper trail is right there. Go to the findings of the church committee. I actually gave you those about a year and a half ago. I dropped them off.
Yes.
Anyway, there it is. It's right there. So Lyndon Johnson, whose head was in the noose, Lyndon Johnson was going to be impeached. And the impeachment vote was coming down 2 o'clock in the afternoon, November 22nd, 1963. If he did not become president by 12:30, 1 o'clock that day, or if he didn't kill the president by then, and then get himself inaugurated illegally, claiming that Robert Kennedy told him he should be inaugurated before leaving Dallas, totally bogus story. But he was stalling, A, to get inaugurated, B, to give enough time for the body of Tippit to be brought out to Love Field. And it was taken to Love Field. The Secret Service stole the O'Neill ambulance. It was a hearse, and it was an ambulance. They would just change the sign depending on which function they were on. So the Secret Service hijacked his ambulance, and he had to go out and get it. So he and Aubrey Reich and a lieutenant from the Dallas Police Department, a Lieutenant Butcher, drove out to Love Field, and they drove out claiming that they were going there to recoup the other to recover the other ambulance. But I believe that they were the ones that were carrying the Tippit in the metal casket that I referred to earlier, and that it was put on one of the airplanes. I've been told that the C-130 carrying the limousine hopscotched over Air Force One and got to Washington earlier. We also know the helicopters landed on the far side of Air Force One. You can hear their noises landing as Lyndon Johnson is arriving and giving his speech. And it's believed that those helicopters ferried the bodies first to Walter Reed, the body, the Tippit body, I believe, to Walter Reed, where it was altered and then taken by ambulance to Bethesda, where it was received by Dennis David, Gerald Koster, and Paul O'Connor. So there you have it. You have the paper trail, you have the committee, You have motivation. You have authority. Lyndon Johnson. I did not know this till last night, that Lyndon Johnson ordered the body to be taken back to Washington against all protests, against every judge and Earl Rose, and, you know, the tug of war that happened that's depicted in the movie JFK. All of that is pretty accurate telling. I met Dr. Crenshaw, who was referred to earlier, the conspiracy of silence. I met him twice, and he said to me, I asked him about the throat wound, and he said to me, Robert, look at my finger. He showed me his pinky, and he held the last digit. He said, the bullet was no bigger than that. It was an entry wound. The work that Dr. Perry did in the tracheotomy was the work of an artist. What you see in the autopsy pictures is the work of a butcher. Okay, and I agree with him. Now, why? Tippett was shot through the head and shot in the torso, but he was not shot in the throat. And so, since it was well known that President Kennedy had been shot in the throat, a throat wound had to be supplied. But the person who did it never saw the real throat wound of President Kennedy, and so he had to guess. He had to guess its position, its size, and the width of the tracheotomy. So they just slashed his throat, and that's what you see. You see Tippett's neck slashed open. It's not a tracheotomy.
So we're out of time. The audience is clear. The photographs, which were not ever released during the Warren Commission, of the photograph that allegedly is the photograph of the president, is actually that of Tippett.
Yes, none of them are President Kennedy's. Only one close-up of the inside of the skull that shows the notch where the bullet hit. That's the only one I recognize in authentic Kennedy autopsy photographs. Anything that shows the face is Officer Tippett.
Robert, we're out of time. Thank you for your contributions and for your decades of diligent work on this.
Thank you, Gary. The credit goes to you. You have been as stalwart as anyone else, and the word would not have gotten out without you. I could know all of this information, but nobody would know it if it were not for you, and I thank you very much.
Robert Morningstar, I'm Gary Knoll, and this is another piece of the puzzle. We will continue. We have more to come, and only at the end, in our final installment, will you see how all the pieces fit together. Thank you for listening.